a couple of minutes, the most sublime, intoxicating minutes of Jesse's life. Kissing is, well, Jesse now understands it's the secret to happiness. She never wants to stop. She tries not to think, just surrenders to their tongues and picks soft lips and the way he smells and tastes. Finally, he pulls away. She's dizzy. He grins.
I've been wanting to do that for a while now.
You have?
Yeah, he says. Haven't you?
She has no answer to this. Pick stands up.
I'm going to grab lunch at Susie's snack bar, he says. Do you want me to bring you something?
Jesse is still in a daze. Chicken? She says.
The fried chicken? He says. Okay, I'll be back.
From her window, Jesse watches Pick ride off. He's so self-assured, the way he swings his hips from side to side on his bike, and then stands straight up on the pedals, head held high. There isn't a boy on earth as magnetic and irresistible as Pick Crimmins. Jesse is in love with him, and she will be in love with him until she dies, and maybe even after that. Jesse and Pick eat their lunch on the tiny deck, and when they finish, Pick clears their trash away. What will happen now? Jesse wonders. What happens is that Pick pulls Jesse inside, away from anyone who might pass by on Plum Lane, and there is some more necking. This time is even better than the first. Jesse is more relaxed. She knows what she's doing. Or at least she does until Pick lifts the bottom of her shirt. Jesse swats his hand away. She doesn't even mean to do this. It's involuntary, a reflex. Pick pulls back. Sorry, he says. He holds both hands up in surrender. I'm getting carried away. We'd better stop. I should get ready for work. Jesse doesn't want to stop, and she knows that Pick still has hours before he has to leave for the North Shore. But she also isn't ready for anything more than kissing. She is thrilled that Pick is getting carried away, but it's scary, too. Terrifying. That afternoon, Jesse writes identical letters to both Leslie and Doris. How's your summer going? My summer is fine. I have to take tennis lessons every morning at the Field and Oar Club. My backhand and my serve are coming along, so if I get invited to a weekend party on Hilton Head, I'll be prepared. Jesse considers crumpling this up and starting over. Leslie might understand what a weekend party on Hilton Head meant, but it'll most certainly go right over Doris's head. The only news I have is that I'm dating someone. His name is Pickford Crimmins, but he goes by Pick. He's 15 years old, from California, and very cute. Blonde hair, light blue eyes, and tanner than even George Hamilton. His family is actually living with my family this summer, which is how we met. I would not say we are going steady yet, although we probably will be soon. Jesse leans back to consider just how blown away Leslie and Doris will be by this news. Of the three of them, it's Jesse Levin who has gotten a boyfriend first. The fact that Pick isn't technically her boyfriend doesn't matter, because Leslie and Doris will never meet him. Also, we are going to Woodstock together in August. Jesse crosses this out. She can imagine Leslie reporting this startling fact to her mother, and then Leslie's mother calling David Levin to ask what on earth he's thinking, allowing his 13-year-old daughter to go to Woodstock. Blair is pregnant with twins, due August 1st. She's here on Nantucket now, and she'll have the babies at the hospital. My brother... Jesse pauses. She doesn't want to say too much about Tiger's secret mission, although Jesse can't imagine that two adolescent girls in Brookline, Massachusetts, knowing about it would matter. Sends letters full of things I can't tell anyone. Kirby... Jesse wants to mention Kirby because all of Jesse's friends, especially Leslie, are obsessed with Kirby. But Jesse hasn't seen or talked to her all summer. Kirby sent a package that contained a tie-dyed Martha's Vineyard t-shirt with a card that said, "Miss you." Other than that, it's like Kirby has fallen off the face of the earth. Is spending the summer on Martha's Vineyard. I'm hoping to be allowed to go visit, but my mom probably won't let me because she's upset about Tiger,
and doesn't want to say goodbye to any more of her children, even for a couple of days. These are the truest words in the whole letter, Jessie realizes. That's all for now. Write back. Your best friend, Jessie. P.S. Thank you again for the record album. I listen to it all the time. White lie, Jessie thinks. She hasn't listened to it even once, and now that she and Exalta are at odds, she can't ask to use Exalta's Magnavox. Plus, it's in the den with the television that Blair watches all day, every day. But again, Leslie and Doris will never know. Jessie seals the letters in envelopes and puts a stamp on each, but she's not allowed to leave the house, so going to the mailbox will have to wait. She leans back in bed and thinks about kissing Pic. I'm getting carried away. Carried away isn't a phrase Jessie has given much thought to before, but now she sees how accurately it describes her mood. She feels like there is wind beneath her, like she is being lifted up into the air. She feels like she's soaring. Her life was one thing when she woke up that morning, and now it is something else entirely. As Jessie and Exalta are walking home from tennis lessons the next morning, Exalta says, Well, Jessica, today is the last day of your grounding. Tomorrow you'll be free to do as you please. Free to do as she pleases. Jessie thinks back to the dinner at the Mad Hatter with her mother. Kate said that Jessie's birthday present would be permission to ride her bike to the beach in the afternoons. Has Kate learned what happened with the necklace? Jessie assumes so, though Kate hasn't said a word about it. It's possible, no, probable, that even Jessie stealing hasn't managed to catch Kate's attention, which is a bad thing, but also, for Jessie, a good thing. Tomorrow, she will go to the beach with Pic. That night, Jessie is awakened by someone yelling. It's Mr. Crimmins, she realizes. She creeps out of bed and cracks her door so she can hear better. Not every word is distinct, but Jessie gets the gist of things. Mr. Crimmins is reprimanding Pic for breaking curfew. Curfew? Jessie didn't realize Pic had a curfew or rules of any kind. He seems not to need them. He sticks to a routine, beach, work, sleep. But when Jessie checks her clock, she sees that it's 3 o'clock in the morning. 3 o'clock in the morning? Is Pic just getting home? Then Jessie remembers the bonfire, but that was the night before. Maybe the staff at the North Shore have a bonfire every night, the way Kirby and her friends used to. Maybe Pic has been accepted by his peers and now has a standing invitation, and maybe in another week or two, he'll be able to bring Jessie with him. There's no way she'll be allowed to go, so she will have to sneak out and will likely get caught. And the only punishment she can imagine that would be severe enough for 2 major infractions in one summer is being sent to boarding school. Jessie worries that Pic will get grounded, just as Jessie's own sentence has been lifted. Do you want to get us kicked out of here? Mr. Crimmins asks. No, sir. We're on thin enough ice as it is. Yes, sir. Jessie hears Pick's feet on the stairs, so she shuts her door and climbs back into bed. There was no mention of grounding. Jessie closes her eyes. Tomorrow, she will wear her yellow bikini. The next morning before tennis, Jessie checks Pic's door, but it's closed tight. He's still asleep. When Jessie gets back from tennis, his bike is gone and his bedroom door is open. He went to the beach, as usual. Jessie changes into her suit and considers packing a lunch, but she doesn't want to waste any time. She races downstairs to the den, where Blair is lounging across the sofa with a pillow crammed between her legs. The big news with Blair is that she's wearing a new dress that Kate ordered for her from a catalog. It's orange corduroy and has a ruffled neckline and long sleeves. And although it's unseasonal, Blair's sweating just lying there, it's an improvement over the disintegrating yellow dress. Can I borrow a dollar? Jessie asks. I'm biking to Surfside, and I want to get a burger at the shack. She worries for a second that Blair will check to see if Jessie is allowed to bike to Surfside, or that she will tell Jessie that spending 50 cents on a burger, a quarter on fries, and a quarter on a Coke is a waste of money when there is perfectly good food in the kitchen. But Blair doesn't even look up. My purse is in my bedroom, she says. Take as much as you want. Okay, thank you, Jesse says. She eyes Blair for a second. Should she be worried about her sister? She looks like an enormous, sad orange zombie entranced by the soap operas on television. Can I get you anything? Me? Blair says. No. Thank you, though. Jesse decides she is never getting pregnant. It's amazing how freedom changes everything. The sun is brighter, the sky bluer, the window boxes of the houses on Fair Street are all first prize winners. Her breath comes easier, and her legs feel sure and strong as she pedals along. She's going to meet Pick at the beach. Once at Surfside, she hunts for Pick's bike in the rack. When she doesn't see it, she panics. What if he went somewhere else? Cisco? Madicat? Steps? Jessie imagines herself on a wild goose chase around the island. But then she sees his bike on the very end, the telltale greenish-black color, the white tape on the handlebars. It's not locked up, which is careless of him but not surprising. Probably Pick is used to life on the commune, where everyone shared and there was no need for locks. Jessie chains her bike to his, and then chains her bike to the rack. There's the enticing smell of burgers and grilled onions wafting over from the shack. Jessie thinks of stopping, but she wants to find Pick first. She took $2 from Blair's wallet so that she could offer to pay for Pick's lunch. Surfside Beach is packed. The wide swath of sand is dotted with colorful umbrellas and blankets and competing music from transistor radios. First, Jessie hears Proud Mary by Creedence, and then, a few seconds later, Touch Me by The Doors. The crowd is mostly families, but here and there are groups of teenagers, boys tossing a football, girls rubbing baby oil on their arms and legs. Jessie scans the beach for Pick. She imagines he swims a lot, then naps. Maybe he's invited to join these football games. She hopes he is. This is a busy, happy beach, and for that reason, sitting alone seems like a maudlin prospect. Jessie! Jessie lifts her gaze, and yes, down toward the water she sees Pick in his mustard-colored trunks waving at her. She can't hide her smile as she shuffles through the hot sand in her flip-flops. Pick grins. I thought that was you, he says. But imagine my surprise. You've not only been sprung from jail, you ventured all the way out here on your own. He checks behind her. You're alone, right? Or did your mom come? I'm here alone, Jessie says. Her cheeks burn. He certainly didn't think she'd come to the beach with her mother. Then Jessie notices that behind Pick, lying on a beach towel that Jessie recognizes from All's Fair, is a girl in a black bikini. When Pick sees Jessie notice her, he says, Oh, hey, come meet Sabrina. Jessie's legs suddenly feel weak and watery. She tells herself to breathe. This is nothing to worry about. Sabrina jumps to her feet. Sabrina is Pick's age, 15 or 16, and Sabrina is beautiful. She has a blonde ponytail, a toothy smile, actual breasts, and toenails painted the color of strawberries. Hey, Sabrina says. She offers her hand like an adult. I'm Sabrina. You must be Jessie. Pick talks about you all the time. Hi, Jessie squeaks. She's slightly bolstered by this statement. Pick talks about her all the time, but she's afraid it doesn't mean what she wants it to mean. And sure enough, Pick wraps an arm around Sabrina's shoulders and kisses her cheek. Sabrina is a waitress at the North Shore, Pick says, and last night, she agreed to be my girlfriend. He beams at Jessie. It feels as though he has just crushed her heart under his bike tire, or picked her heart up like a shell at the shoreline and chucked it out to sea. Agreed to be my girlfriend. Sabrina elbows Pick in the ribs. You know I only said yes because I'm dying to go to Woodstock. Woodstock or bust, Pick says. 4 weeks from now, I should have a pile of money saved. Sabrina smiles at Jessie. Set your things down, she says. Then we can go for a swim. Oh, Jessie says. I'm not staying. I just came to say hi. She squints out at the ocean through her gathering tears. The water sparkles, and Jessie is hot from biking, so hot. But there's no way she can stay here at the beach, no way she can swim with Sabrina and Pick. Sabrina is Pick's girlfriend. They are going steady, and Sabrina, not Jessie, is going with Pick to Woodstock. But what about the other day? The necking in Little Fair. It wasn't just a peck on the cheek. They had really been kissing. What changed? Pick had gone to a bonfire, maybe two bonfires. And it's true that Jessie hadn't really seen him since then, but she had relived the kissing in her mind 1,000 times, and she assumed he had too. But the necking with Jessie must not have lived up to his expectations, because now look, she has been relegated to little sister status. She should have let him go further. She should have let him put his hand under her shirt. But it had been so new then, and she hadn't been ready. It seems wildly unfair that now Pick is kissing Sabrina and putting his hand beneath Sabrina's shirt. Now Pick and Sabrina are getting carried away, and Jessie is left behind. She turns and wanders through the maze of blankets and towels. She's careful, even in her agitated state, not to kick sand on anyone. One of the transistor radios is playing Sweet Judy Blue Eyes. It's getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore. Jessie! Pick calls out. She hears him, but she doesn't look back. She knows not to do that, at least. In the parking lot, she unlocks her bike from Pick's and from the rack, and in one small juvenile gesture, she kicks Pick's bike to the ground. When Jessie arrives back at all's fair in love and war, she thinks, and she shudders at how cruel her own house's name now seems, she hears her mother's raised voice in the kitchen. Jessie couldn't care less. She will write to her father and tell him about Garrison rubbing against her, or about Exalta's anti-Semitism, or that Kate is drinking so much Jessie doesn't feel safe, and she will be allowed to return home. She needs to get off this island. If she stays, she will die, or at least the inside of her will die. Even now, her stomach hurts. She's certain she will never eat again, never sleep again, never be happy or carefree again. She has learned the hard way that love ruins everything. As Jessie is heading up the stairs to Little Fair, she hears her mother say Mr. Crimmin's name, and then Pick's name, and curiosity gets the better of her, and she heads for the kitchen. Kate and Exalta are facing each other with their arms crossed. Jessie has walked in on a showdown. "What's going on?" she asks. "The Crimminses are leaving," Kate says. "Leaving?" Jessie says. "Moving out," Kate says. Jessie can't believe her good luck. She feels a little lighter. "Nonsense," Exalta says. "Bill Crimmins is well into his 70s and the boy is 15. We can't just put them out on the street." "We most certainly can," Kate says. "Bill Crimmins is a fraud." "I'm sure he tried his best," Exalta says. "And I hate to remind you of this, darling, but this is my house, and the only person with a say about who stays or goes is me." "Mother, please," Kate says. "Try to see it from my point of view. Think how difficult it is for me." "Jessie and Pick are friendly," Exalta says. "It's good for her to have another young person around." She looks up and sees Jessie. "Aren't you fond of young Pickford, Jessica?" Jessie is finally starting to think like a tennis player. It feels like Exalta has just lobbed a ball to her forehead. "Charge the net," she thinks. "Actually, Nani, I don't like Pick. I don't like him at all. I think he's..." She tries to be strategic with her choice of words. "Common." She looks at her mother. "And dangerous. A bad influence. He asked me to go with him to Woodstock." "Woodstock!" Kate cries. Exalta looks nonplussed. "Think of how the boy has been raised, or not raised, as the case may be. We can hardly evict him. And I won't do that to Bill, not after the years, the decades, he has faithfully served this household." "He's caused us more trouble than he saved us," Kate says. "That's nonsense, and you know it, Catherine," Exalta says. "I will hear nothing else about it. They are staying put." "Mother," Kate says. "Nani," Jessie says. "Enough," Exalta says. Jesse trudges up to her bedroom. She feels doubly cheated now. Triply cheated. No beach, no pick, no chance to be rid of pick. She can't even bring herself to hate Sabrina. Sabrina was nice. Pick is right to make Sabrina his girlfriend. She's pretty, kind, friendly, and older. The problem isn't Sabrina. It's Jesse herself. Jesse's stomach hurts something awful. Even though it's a bright, sunny day, Jesse decides she's going to put on her pajamas and climb into bed. She has a book to read for pleasure. From the mixed-up files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, about some kids who run away from home and end up living in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Jesse wants to run away. That was what Woodstock was all about, but Pick must not even remember that he asked Jesse to go. He must not remember that he tried to kiss Jesse in the buttery, and then he did kiss her, passionately, two separate times. It happened. It wasn't something she dreamed, although now it's destined to feel that way. Jesse gasps when she slips off her bikini bottoms. They're stained with blood. Her period, she thinks. It came. This is something she had been wishing for, praying for even. But now it doesn't matter. Now, she couldn't care less. Can't find my way home. Tiger is in Cambodia. Exalta has overridden Kate's decision to evict Bill Crimmins for his ineffectiveness. David won't come to the island. Kate called him at the office with the intent of telling him about her deal with Bill, but when his secretary put him through, he said, "I'm very busy right now. Can we talk later?" Kate nearly pushed and said, "Later when? How about tonight at 8 o'clock? But she couldn't bear to hear him say that 8 o'clock wouldn't work, that no time would work, because the issue wasn't that he was busy. He was always busy. It was that he didn't want to talk to Kate at all. Her problems, she realizes, are all interconnected. Since she's not allowed to throw Bill Crimmins out, she might persuade him to believe that he's staying due to her good graces, as long as he continues to pressure his brother-in-law for information about Tiger. Part of Kate clings to the idea that this mission in Cambodia, blocking the flow of supplies to the Viet Cong, is less dangerous than combat in Vietnam. But who is she kidding? It's all dangerous. Once she has a reliable source confirming the Tiger is at least safe, Kate can stop numbing herself with alcohol, and she will be restored to David's favor. Kate catches Bill bright and early on his way out to his pickup truck, which he parks on Plum Lane, and says, "I'm sorry about my temper the other day, Bill. I was distraught about Tiger." Bill softens immediately. She can see forgiveness in his face. He is a good man, and Exalta is right. He has placed himself in service to this house and their family for over 3 decades. That Kate now harbors some anger and resentment toward Bill Crimmins, and worse, that she feels disillusioned by him, is breaking her heart along with everything else in her life. Bill puts a hand on her shoulder.
"I understand, Katie. I've lost a child myself."
Kate nearly says, "You have?" She wonders if maybe Bill's wife, who died so long ago that Kate never knew her, lost a baby. But then she realizes he means Lorraine, and she nearly growls at him. Lorraine isn't lost the way Tiger is lost. Comparing them is nothing short of offensive, but Kate will let it go. She supposes that, regardless of the circumstances, Bill must miss his daughter. "I'm happy to let you and Pick stay," Kate says. The child's name sticks like a fishbone in her throat. "Stay for as long as you need, of course. It was cruel of me to pull the rug out from under you. But if you would please continue to pursue your brother-in-law for any news he has about Tiger..."
"Of course," Bill says. His eyes shine. "I miss him too, Katie. I think of him like one of my own."
There's a lot of emotional distance between having a child of one's own and thinking of a child as one's own, although Bill has known Tiger since he was born and they were always close. They both love the Red Sox and tinkering with cars. Would Tiger trust Bill Crimmins with his life? Probably, Kate has to admit. "Thank you," she whispers.
There is one other action she can take to fix the mess she finds herself in, something previously unthinkable. Once Jessie and Exalta leave for the club, Kate secures a scarf over her hair, puts on her sunglasses, and climbs into the scout. Up the cobblestones of Main Street she goes. It feels like being inside a cocktail shaker. Kate rumbles around the Civil War monument and along Upper Main. She passes her two favorite houses. They both back onto the grassy fields that border Quarter Mile Hill. One is rustic and barn-like, with crisscross ironwork over the wavy leaded glass windows. The other is a luscious white confection that features a front portico with Ionic columns and two glassed-in porches. These homes are the best mix of town and country, and Kate fantasizes about telling Exalta that she has bought a house on Upper Main, the only address that would qualify in everyone's mind as superior to fair. But alas, Kate doesn't have that kind of money, and those houses stay in families for 5 or 6 or 10 generations. At the flagpole at Caton Circle, Kate checks her watch, 4 minutes. 4 minutes isn't so bad, but she's still quite a distance from her destination. She drives out Maticot Road. The Chase Barn is on the left, but after that, homes are few and far between. Still, it's a lovely ride, isn't it? On the right, Maxie Pond glitters like a mirror, and then Kate sails up to the top of the hill to overlook the rolling green acres of Sanford Farm. There are 27 curves on Maticot Road. Kate wonders what it would be like to drive them in the dark after a few cocktails. All the way out at the end of the road is the hamlet of Maticot. Maticot Millie lives in one of the cottages out here on Hither Creek. She's the closest thing Nantucket has to a folk hero. She served as a coastal defense specialist in World War II and spent long hours watching for ships in distress and German U-boats. It's well known that she's curmudgeonly and will befriend only children, animals, and her Maticot neighbors. Kate considers introducing herself to Maticot Millie and inviting her to lunch at the Field and Oar Club. This feels like a radical idea, but is it? Bitsy Dunscombe will likely never speak to Kate again. Kate could use a new friend to replace her, so why not Maticot Millie? The island is much bigger than she realized. Kate turns left at the first unmarked dirt road after the harbor, Massasoit Bridge Road. She cruises over the eponymous bridge and checks her watch, 16 minutes from town. When Massasoit Bridge Road dead ends, Kate turns left and immediately spies the structure that originally gave Red Barn Road its name. The barn is faded to a dusty pink, and part of the roof is caving in. It's no longer in use, but it retains a certain charm. Andrew Wyeth might have painted this barn, with the flat, windswept acres behind it and the ocean in front. There's only one other structure on this road, the 6-bedroom home David found listed for sale in the newspaper. Kate spies it up ahead. She pulls into the spacious drive. The house has gray shingles and white trim that are weathered and peeling, respectively, in a way that suggests gravitas and character rather than neglect. The house is tall and wide. Both All's Fair and Little Fair would fit inside. From the front porch, there are uninterrupted views of the ocean. Kate is enraptured. Here, there's no mistaking you're on an island. Kate tries the front door. It's unlocked, so she walks right in. The house is immediately welcoming. There's a living room on the left, a dining room with a grand pedestal table surrounded by 10 ladder-back chairs on the right, and a flight of stairs up the middle. The back of the house features an eat-in kitchen with big windows that look back on what used to be farmland. There is, in fact, plenty of room for both a tennis court and a swimming pool. And although Kate scorned David for suggesting it, she cringes remembering her own sharp tongue. Why does he remain married to her? She now thinks how wonderful it would be to create a proper summer estate out here. She had previously thought it garish and gauche, but neither is true if there are no neighbors to witness it. Upstairs, Kate finds a medley of bedrooms and bathrooms and closets. The entire upstairs is painted white, and every time Kate turns a corner, there's another bedroom, another bath. Some of the bedrooms have twin beds, some a double bed. Two connect through a Jack and Jill bathroom with a double vanity. There's a spacious linen closet and a nursery that still contains a crib. There is one room where the walls are lined with books, the swollen paperbacks of summer, and Kate imagines a future time when her mind will be quiet enough that she can read again. Expecting another closet, she opens a door to find a set of stairs, which she climbs up to an attic. It's a finished space, though brutally hot. It needs a powerful standing fan that's furnished with 6 built-in bunk beds. The quality of the bunk beds is high. The wood is solid and true, and the mattresses look new. Kate imagines that the man of the house built these for his grandchildren, maybe at their behest, maybe as a surprise. And the brothers and sisters and cousins treasured their time up here away from the adults, telling secrets, making up ghost stories. Kate wonders if she will ever have enough grandchildren to fill this room. She returns to the second floor to find the room that will be Tiger's. One of the front rooms, she decides, with a big bed and a half bath. When Tiger comes home, he can marry McGee, and the two of them can sleep in this room and wake up to the sun's first rays hitting the water. The other front bedroom will be for her and David. It's the master, and it has an ensuite bath with a clawfoot tub. There are rooms for Blair, Kirby, and Jesse, and one guest room that will be home to boyfriends or college roommates or in-laws. Kate stands at the top of the stairs looking down. She hadn't expected to like the house this much. She had not expected to like it at all. She came to see it with dual purposes, neither of them noble, to escape Exalta and to appease David. But what she has found is a place that the entire family can call home. It's not fancy. There's no crown molding, no priceless murals, nowhere to hang proper drapes. There are no brick floors, and there's no kitchen fireplace or quaint buttery. It has no pedigree, really. If Kate had to guess, she would say the house was built with stock market money in the prosperous 20s as a summer resort by people who loved nature and their privacy. The house feels like home. It feels like the place where she and David might happily spend the 1970s, the 1980s, and, if they're lucky, the 1990s. Maybe they'll even watch the sunrise on the new millennium here. The year 2000. It's only 31 years away, and yet it feels like science fiction. The thought sustains her. She will usher in the next 1,000 years here, on Red Barn Road. Kate can't risk calling Laundry Real Estate from the house, nor can she go to the office in person, as someone she knows might see her and report back to Exalta. She decides to call from the bank of payphones at the Nantucket Electric Company building. It's midday and another scorcher. Town is deserted, which is a good thing. There's always a chance someone might notice her using the payphone and wonder if Kate is having an affair. Bitsy Dunscombe would most definitely suspect that. Kate needs to be quick. There's only one other person at the bank of phones, a blonde teenager with his back to Kate. He's yelling into the receiver. Where is she? Have you heard from her? No? Not anything? When he slams down the phone, Kate gasps. Pick? Kate says. It's the first time she has used his name. Bill Crimmins tactfully skipped a proper introduction, though naturally Kate and Pick have seen each other in passing. He's always on his bike, either heading to the beach or to work, or returning from the beach or from work. If he looks over and sees her, he waves and she waves back. Pick seems upset by the call and embarrassed to be recognized. He draws his forearm across his eyes. Was the boy crying? Kate replays his words, and suddenly she understands. He must have been looking for his mother. Hey, Mrs. Levin, he says. He gestures toward the phone with a theatrical flourish. All yours. He turns to go. She sees his bike resting against the telephone pole. She would normally be grateful for an easy exit. She has sensitive business to discuss that she doesn't want him to overhear. Plus, she feels very uncomfortable around him. She can't bring herself to look at him too closely. but he's in such obvious distress, she can't let it go unremarked.
Pic, are you okay? Is everything all right? Are you trying to find Lorraine?
He nods while looking at the pavement. Then he meets Kate's eyes.
You knew her, right? My mom?
Oh, Kate says. It serves her right for opening her mouth. I knew her a long time ago. But yes, she worked for our family for years.
Kate swallows.
She used to keep an eye on the children, my older children, when they were very young.
I don't know where she is, Pic says. I don't know where she went or when she's coming back. There's stuff I want to tell her. This whole summer. I mean, I got a job and got promoted to the hotline.
Kate smiles. Congratulations.
And I have a new girlfriend. Her name is Sabrina. She's the prettiest waitress at the restaurant, and she's funny, too, and smart. There are these two old ladies who come to eat at the restaurant all the time, and Sabrina calls them arsenic and old lace.
Pic's eyes, she notices, are Lorraine's eyes, the frosted blue of sea glass.
I'm sorry.
Kate places a hand on his arm. He's as brown as a berry, as the saying goes.
Don't apologize. If anyone understands missing someone, it's me. My son is overseas.
Jesse told me, Pic says. You must be proud.
I am, Kate says. But it's difficult, of course.
They stand together another few seconds without anything to say. Then Kate turns to the phone.
Well, I'd better make my call.
Pic climbs on his bike. See you at home.
Home, she thinks.
He's lived there 4 weeks with people he barely knows, and he considers it home. That's either wonderful or the saddest thing Kate has ever heard. She can't decide which. She drops a dime in the slot and dials the number.
Laundry Real Estate, the receptionist says.
Yes, Kate says. I'd like to make an offer on a house.
Fly Me to the Moon. Reprise. Almost by magic, Blair wakes up one morning and feels fine. She feels better than fine. She feels energized. She climbs out of bed and puts on her dress. The orange corduroy dress Kate bought her is just too hot to wear in mid-July, but having it has given Blair the chance to wash, iron, and mend her trusty yellow dress, which she has nicknamed Old Yeller. She gets downstairs to breakfast before Exalta and Jesse leave for Jesse's tennis lesson. Jesse stares morosely into her bowl of cereal. 2 days earlier, Jesse had tapped on Blair's door to tell her she had gotten her period.
What do I do? Jesse asked.
Blair had nearly said, go find Mom, but these days talking to Kate was as effective as talking to someone on television. Kate couldn't be relied on or confided in these days. That was okay. Blair would use this opportunity to hone her maternal skills. She hauled herself up off the sofa.
I'll go to Congdon's pharmacy, Blair said. Run up and fetch my purse.
Later, after she showed Jesse how to best manage her monthly, she said,
We should go out and get you a bra.
Jesse had reddened.
Facts of life, Blair said.
This morning, after Exalta excuses herself to get dressed before they leave for the club, Blair touches Jesse's shoulder.
You and me, this afternoon, she says. Butners.
For breakfast, Blair eats a banana with peanut butter. Then she cleans up everyone's dishes and sets a glass of orange juice and a bowl of lightly sugared strawberries at her mother's place. She heads back upstairs and changes the sheets on her bed for the first time since she's arrived. She loves the feeling of fresh, clean sheets. The ones she has chosen are white with sprigs of lavender printed on them. When the bed is made and the pillows plumped, Blair takes the dirty sheets down to the washing machine, then sets up the clothesline in the yard. It's a glorious day, and she wants nothing more than to sit on the steps and raise her face to the sun. But there's no time to waste. She has a lot to accomplish. She goes upstairs to pack her bag for the hospital. A nightgown she abandoned 4 months ago that she hopes will fit once the twins are born. Slippers, hairbrush, perfume, curlers, toothbrush, compact, and a copy of Dr. Spock that she has yet to even crack open. She straightens her room, dusts the top of the dresser, then pulls the vacuum out of the hall closet. She runs the sweeper over the wood floors and the braided rug. She goes downstairs, pulls the linens out of the washing machine, and hangs them on the line. She hears Exalta and Jesse arrive home. Perfect timing, she thinks. She'll take Jesse to Butner's, and then to the charcoal galley to celebrate her entry into womanhood. Blair intercepts Jesse as she's striding across the backyard to Little Fair. Hey, get changed. We're going to Butner's, then out to lunch. Okay, Jesse says. She looks a little happier than she did that morning. But then Blair hears voices, and Jesse's expression collapses like a souffle. Blair peeks out from behind the hanging bedsheets to see Pick approaching on his bike with a pretty blonde perched on the handlebars. They come to a screeching halt on Plum Lane, and the girl laughs as she tumbles off the bike and onto the street, just barely managing to stay on her feet. Hey, Jesse, Pick calls out.
Hey, Jesse,
the girl with him says. Jesse storms into Little Fair without a word. Uh-oh, Blair thinks. She strides over to the gate to let the happy couple through.
Hey, Pick, she says.
She offers her hand to the girl.
Hello there, I'm Blair.
Sabrina, the girl says. She gives Blair a winning smile. She is all white teeth, blue eyes, small, perky breasts. She reminds Blair of a sugar cookie.
I'm Pick's girlfriend.
Pick's girlfriend? This is the first Blair has heard of a girlfriend, though she realizes she has hardly paid attention to anyone but herself this summer.
Nice to meet you, Blair says.
She supposes Jesse's rebuff of these two can mean only one thing.
Where are you guys headed?
I'm going to make Sabrina some lunch, Pick says.
He nods at Little Fair.
Upstairs.
Your grandfather isn't home, Blair says, so I'm going to have to put a damper on those plans, I'm afraid. I can't let the two of you go up unchaperoned.
Pick makes a face so familiar that Blair gets chills. She must be having flashbacks of Lorraine.
Jesse just went upstairs, he says. She can be our chaperone.
I'm taking Jesse out, Blair says. Sorry, Pick, I know it's a drag, but those are the house rules. They've been in existence since I was your age. You guys are welcome to go to the big house. I believe both my mother and grandmother are around.
Pick sighs. No thanks. I guess we'll just go get a burger at the charcoal galley.
Foiled, Blair thinks.
But that's quite all right. She can take Jesse to Sy's green coffee pot.
Toodaloo,
she says. On the way down Main Street to Butner's, Blair tells Jesse,
So, I met Pick's girlfriend.
No response from her sister.
She seemed nice.
Jesse shrugs.
She's very pretty.
I guess, Jesse says.
Not as pretty as you, of course, Blair says.
Jesse stops in her tracks.
Blair?
Yes?
Please stop.
Blair feels a pain in her midsection, as though the words pierced her.
Okay, sorry.
Let's just get this over with, Jesse says, and she flings open the door to Butner's.
Butner's smells the same, Blair thinks, like the new leather of school shoes and the boiled wool of peacoats and the saleswomen's perfume and floor polish. Blair has been coming to this store her entire life. She prefers it to any place in Boston, even Filene's. She leads Jesse back to the lingerie department and finds Miss Timsey, the same woman who fitted Blair for her bra 12 years earlier. Francesca Timsey is a spinster, a Nantucket native who lives with her sister, Donatella Timsey, in a tiny cottage on Farmer Street. Both Timsey sisters sing in the choir at St. Paul's. They're as old as the hills, and yet, curiously, Miss Timsey looks exactly the same as she did 12 years ago. Blue hair, set once a week at Claire Elaine's beauty shop next door, steel-rimmed glasses, pencil skirt, and tape measure draped around her neck.
Katie Nichols? Miss Timsey says, Is that you? You're having another baby?
Blair puts a hand on Miss Timsey's stick-thin forearm.
It's Blair Foley, Miss Timsey.
Kate's daughter. I'm pregnant with twins.
Blair is tickled to be mistaken for her glamorous mother, although she's certain it's because Miss Timsey is almost completely senile. Miss Timsey seems to snap right back to the summer of 1969 because she says,
"Oh, Blair, dear, of course. My eyes were playing tricks on me. Not surprising, with the heat we've been having. I heard you were pregnant with twins. Donatella ran into your mother at the market."
"Well, we're here today to get my sister Jessie a bra," Blair says.
Jessie curls into herself, and Blair realizes her voice is louder than normal because she's trying to accommodate Miss Timsey's ancient ears.
"Her first bra."
Miss Timsey regards Jessie.
"Sister," she says, "this isn't Kirby. Kirby's blonde."
"This isn't Kirby," Blair says.
She notices Jessie trying to make herself even smaller, and she hopes she doesn't have to run through the family calculus with Miss Timsey.
"This is Jessica, the youngest."
Thankfully, Miss Timsey has moved on to business. She eyes Jessie's chest.
"Well, I can tell you're going to have a magnificent bosom in a few short years. Come, let's get you fitted."
Jessie throws Blair a pleading look, but Blair pretends not to see. Miss Timsey is a professional, and being fitted by her is a rite of passage. Blair survived, Kirby survived, Jessie will survive.
"I'll be over in the layette section," Blair calls out.
She meanders through the women's department, admiring the fall fashions, out already, even though it's only mid-July, and feels another sharp pain. She wonders if she'll even fit into regular clothes by fall. She moves on to the children's section and is haunted by memories of back-to-school shopping with Kate and Exalta. She even remembers one year when Tiger was in a baby carriage, so Blair's father must have still been alive. She remembers another year when she chose a paisley blouse that had a matching orange skirt, but somehow the skirt hadn't made it home to Brookline, and Blair cried because she had wanted to wear the outfit on the first day of school. Kate had called Butner's and they mailed the skirt, but had it made it in time? Blair can't remember. So much of what seems painfully important in the moment fades away. Jessie is embarrassed about being fitted for a bra now, but 10 years from now, when she has the magnificent bosom that Miss Timsey predicted, she'll be buying black lace bras and push-up bras to impress her boyfriends. And maybe one afternoon, as she's having brunch with girlfriends at the Marliov, she'll tell them the story of getting her first bra at Butner's. Finally, Blair arrives at the baby section. Toddler, infants, newborn layette. She has nothing for the twins, and no one has sent anything. Blair decides to choose 4 outfits for each gender, just to cover her bases. The clothes are precious, tiny and delicate like fine doll clothes. Blair gets 4 basic white onesies, 2 with pink piping, 2 with blue, and 4 sailor suits, 2 male, 2 female. The sailor suits are impractical, she knows, but she can't resist. She hands the outfits over to the sales girl, who takes them to the register.
"You'll need to wait to ring these up," Blair says. "My sister is being fitted for a bra."
Blair heads back to lingerie to see how Jessie is faring. She can hear Miss Timsey's incessant patter.
"You see, my dear, how this one provides lift? Shoulders back now, chin up."
Suddenly, Blair feels a staggering pain. It's like giant hands are squeezing her midsection. There's a sound like the muted pop of a balloon, and water comes gushing out from between Blair's legs. She screams. Miss Timsey pokes her head out from behind the dressing room curtain, and the sales girl rushes over to take Blair's arm.
"Are you okay, miss?"
Then the sales girl notices the puddle forming at Blair's feet. Liquid is running down Blair's bare legs, and Blair is mortified and confused, thinking she somehow lost control of her bladder and wet herself. But a split second later, she realizes her water has broken right in the middle of Butner's next to a carousel of boys' dungarees. A pain comes that is so rude and insistent that Blair knows this is it. Contractions. Labor.
"Jessie," she says, "we need to go now."
Jessie pops out of the dressing room in just her shorts and a white bra.
"Put your shirt on," Blair says. "We have to go. I'm in labor. It's time."
Miss Timsey says,
Let us call an ambulance.
No, no, Blair says. She isn't about to make a scene. It's bad enough she's leaving them to clean up after her.
We have to go. My bag, my things. My mother will take me. It's fine.
Blinding pain. Blair grits her teeth, counts to 10. It passes. She and Jesse walk up Main Street, Blair holding on to Jesse's arm for dear life. Right outside of Mitchell's book corner, Blair feels another contraction coming on. It's like a truck is about to hit her.
We have to stop for a minute, Blair says.
There's a bench outside the store, and Blair hears Jesse asking her if she wants to sit, but Jesse's voice is faint and far away. There is only room in Blair's head for her own thoughts and the searing white-hot pain. She doesn't think sitting will help. It may make things worse. If anything could be worse than being in labor on Main Street in the broiling hot sun. The contraction barrels down. Blair's knees buckle, but Jesse holds her steady.
Should I run for Mom? Jesse asks.
Blair can't talk until the contraction is past.
And leave me here? No, let's go.
They make it to the corner of Main and Fair, but another contraction is coming. Blair says,
You go. I'll be right here.
Jesse races up the street. Blair braces herself against a tree. The Quaker Meeting House is across the street, quiet, calm, serene. Blair wills herself to think about the Quaker Meeting House, but the pain is overwhelming. It consumes her. She's crying and sweating and cursing the day she ever met Angus. Angus, who is 1,000 miles away in Houston. Blair tries to recall today's date. She thinks it's the 15th, so the moon launch is tomorrow, right? It doesn't matter. Angus is so unavailable, he might as well be on the moon. A car pulls up, and Blair casts her eyes down, willing it to move on. Her legs are sticky with fluid, the back of her dress is soaked, and she wants to disappear. What she fears most right now is a Good Samaritan.
Blair!
It's her mother and Jesse and the scout. Jesse hops out and walks Blair over to the passenger side. But how will she ever get up and in? She faces the car while Jesse pushes from under her buttocks and somehow boosts Blair up. Another contraction is coming.
We can't go down the cobblestones, Blair says.
What? Kate says.
But darling, there's no other way. We cannot go down the cobblestones, Blair says in a voice that sounds nothing like her own. Back up!
Back up? Kate says.
Fair Street is one way, darling.
Back up, Mom, Jesse says. No one is behind us. I'll keep watch. Another contraction is coming. Blair howls. Kate backs up.
Keep going! Keep going, Jesse says. It's clear all the way to Lucretia Mott.
Thank you, God, Blair thinks. Lucretia Mott Lane to Pine Street, Pine Street to Lyons, Lyons to South Mill, which meets Prospect Street right across from the hospital. Kate screeches to a stop in the emergency room parking lot, and two orderlies appear with a stretcher.
You're not leaving me, are you?
Blair asks her mother.
We'll be right behind you, darling, Kate says. You won't be alone.
Blair closes her eyes. She won't be alone. Kate and Jesse will be here. Someone is missing, Blair thinks.
Someone is missing,
Blair mumbles to the orderly. Oh, yeah? He says. Your husband?
Angus? She thinks. No.
The person missing is Kirby. Blair is in labor for 18 hours, which sounds grueling, although truthfully, it's only the beginning and the end of labor that are challenging. The contractions come fast and hard until Dr. Vandenberg arrives and instructs the nurse, Myrtle, to give Blair something to make her comfortable. Here comes your glass of wine, Myrtle says as she shoots something into Blair's IV. She's in twilight sleep much of the night. She wakes up at dawn when the nurse tells her it's time to push. Kate is there at the bedside, and Jesse is sitting on a stool in the corner of the room. This would never be allowed in a big city hospital, Blair knows, but she's glad they bend the rules here a little. Jesse is wearing a surgical mask, which looks so funny on her that Blair actually laughs. Dr. Vandenberg reappears in blue scrubs. Who wants to have a baby or two? He asks. He checks Blair and says, The first baby is crowning, Blair. Bear down.
This is happening. Blair is overcome with emotion. She is going to have a baby, two babies. She is about to create a family right here, right now, on July 16th, 1969, the same day that man will head to the moon. Angus must be consumed by the imminent launch, checking and rechecking calculations, in constant contact with Kate Kennedy. He will have no idea that on an island 30 miles from the Massachusetts shore, his children are about to enter the world.
Push, Blair, push, Dr. Vandenberg says.
Blair pushes.
Again, Dr. Vandenberg says.
Push, darling, Kate says. Blair looks at her mother. Kate's hair is in its usual chignon. There are pearls at her neck. She's wearing a peach dress. She has an iron grip on Blair's hand, and Blair can feel Kate passing her her strength, gifting her her fortitude. Blair knows her mother endured this, and Nani before her, and Nani's mother before her, and so on and so on. Blair hopes Jesse is watching, so she learns that all women are strong and miraculous.
Strong, Blair thinks. Miraculous.
It's a girl, Dr. Vandenberg says. She's perfect.
A girl, Blair thinks, and her heart soars. Jesse is on her feet, her eyes wide, her fists clenched with nerves or joy. Kate sniffs, wipes a tear.
My granddaughter, she says.
Dr. Vandenberg hands the baby to Myrtle as though it's a loaf of bread he pulled from the oven. We aren't finished, he says. You can take a couple of deep breaths until we're ready to go again.
Blair turns to her mother. I bought outfits. Miss Timsey brought them up to the house, Kate says, along with three bras for Jesse. Thank you for handling that. I meant to do it.
Here we go, Dr. Vandenberg says. The head is crowning.
I'm wagering on another girl, Myrtle says. Probably identical.
Push, Dr. Vandenberg says.
Blair bears down. Kate squeezes her hand. You are such a champion, darling.
Blair lets a great moan go as she pushes with all her might. Again, please, Dr. Vandenberg says.
I can't, Blair whimpers.
You can, darling, Kate says. Come on now.
Blair pushes again, and she feels a loosening, a lightening. It's a boy, Dr. Vandenberg says, his voice jubilant. A beautiful baby boy. You have a girl and a boy, Mama. A son and a daughter.
Blair bursts into tears. Telegram to Dr. Angus Whalen, Mission Control, Houston, Texas. Genevieve Foley Whalen, 6 pounds 2 ounces, born 6:38 a.m. George Nichols Whalen, 5 pounds 14 ounces, born 6:44 a.m. Mother and babies doing fine. 2 hours later, after the babies have been cleaned and swaddled, and after Blair has delivered the placentas and been stitched up, and after Blair has successfully latched each baby to her breasts for the first meal of their lives, Blair asks to see a TV. It's almost 9 a.m. The launch is supposed to take place in half an hour.
Myrtle frowns. Don't you want to sleep?
My husband is an astrophysicist, Blair says. He has been working on this mission for years. That's why he's not here. He's in Houston, at Mission Control.
Hold on, Myrtle says. She disappears down the hall and returns a few minutes later, holding a small, boxy, black-and-white TV, which she sets on the table at the foot of Blair's bed.
This is the TV we keep in the nurse's station, Myrtle says.
She plugs it in and fiddles with the antennas until the picture becomes clear. Cape Kennedy in Florida and the thousands of people who are attending the launch. There are photos of the three astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins, on the screen, and Blair gets chills. She wants to announce that although those gentlemen are going out into space, there are lots of other people who made it possible, among them Dr. Angus Whalen.
The happy drugs are definitely working because, after a quick self-inventory, Blair doesn't find a hint of anger or resentment toward Angus for missing the birth. He was busy doing his job while Blair did hers. This isn't a feminist position, she knows, but she can't be moved to care. She has twins, a matched set, a daughter and a son. When Dr. Vanderberg says, "Good job, Mama," he was referring to her, Blair. She's the mama. The candy striper in the maternity ward, Tracy, follows Myrtle. She's carrying two bottles of Asti Spumante in a bedpan full of ice. "We broke out the champagne because twin births are so rare here," Myrtle says. Blair claps her hands. "Let's all have some when the rocket takes off." "We're on the clock," Myrtle says, "but a sip or two won't hurt. After all, this is a monumental event. Twins and the moon launch on the same day." Tracy the candy striper goes to fetch paper cups while Myrtle pops the cork. The engines thrust, a fiery cloud bursts from below the rocket, and the newscaster, excitement barely disguised in his voice, counts down. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, blast off. Blair raises her paper cup of Asti Spumante to the others in the room and lets out a whoop. "Cheers," she cries. "Here's to the next frontier." This toast, she thinks, works on so many levels. Dr. Vanderberg appears in the doorway and watches as the rocket breaks through the atmosphere. He turns to the room with an expression of genuine wonder. "Your children are entering a remarkable world," he says. Telegram to Blair Foley Whalen, Nantucket Cottage Hospital, maternity ward. "Received the happy news of the twins. Sending my best wishes and congratulations. Will return to Boston July 25th. Angus." Ring of Fire. July 17th, 1969. Dear Tiger, Jessie now thinks of Tiger as her own version of Anne Frank's Kitty because she isn't at all convinced that Tiger will ever read this letter. This doubt gives her freedom. If it's a letter that will never be read, then she can write the entire, unfiltered truth. It has been a busy week. Jessie nearly starts by telling Tiger that she got her period, but then she hesitates, because what if he does end up reading this? He'll be so grossed out, and rightly so, that he might crumple up the letter and throw it away without getting to the good stuff. On Tuesday afternoon, Blair took me to Butner's to get some new clothes. She considers mentioning that they were, in fact, bra shopping, but again she censors herself, though she's certain Tiger would laugh at Miss Timsey's declaration that Jessie would one day have a magnificent bosom. "While I was in the changing room half-dressed..." Jessie had been standing in a bra and shorts while Miss Timsey stood behind her, fiddling with the length of the straps. "I heard a shriek. I poked my head out to find that Blair's water had broken all over the floor of Butner's. She was in labor. The sales ladies at Butner's offered to call an ambulance, but Blair insisted we walk home, even though she was in a lot of pain. We had to stop a bunch of times, once right in front of Bosun's locker, and I was afraid the babies were going to come then and there and that one of the Bosun's regulars would have to deliver them. But finally, Blair let me run ahead to get Mom. Blair refused to drive over the cobblestones, so Mom drove in reverse the wrong way down Fair Street in order to get to the hospital. Thank goodness Nonnie didn't see. So now comes the important news. You're officially an uncle. You have a niece named Genevieve Foley Whalen and a nephew named George Nichols Whalen." Jessie wonders if Angus will object to both babies being named after Blair's family. Then she wonders if Angus picked the names Genevieve and George, though she kind of doubts it. No one at the hospital asked about Angus, which Jessie found surprising until she reasoned that, historically, there were a lot of fishermen, whalers and the like, on Nantucket, as well as a lot of summer wives like Kate, women whose husbands worked in the city during the week. So maybe a birth with no father present was more common than Jessie imagined.
Angus wasn't here, because yesterday was the day the Apollo 11 mission took off for the moon.
Would Tiger know about the moon launch? Jesse wonders. Do they get newspapers?
Tiger and Jesse had watched Apollo 8 in its moon orbit on Christmas Eve and listened to the astronauts read from the Book of Genesis, and they'd agreed it was a good way to end a terrible year.
He's in Houston, working at Mission Control, and when Blair told the nurses this, they brought a television into the room so we could watch. They also brought two bottles of champagne, and they even gave me a cup.
Jesse considers how much she wants to share with Tiger, because the fact is, Jesse had more than one cup of champagne. Everyone had been engrossed by the moon launch, so when Jesse finished her own champagne, she drank Blair's and Myrtle the nurse's. Jesse had never tasted alcohol before, and after an initial aversion to the taste, it was fizzy like soda but sour and bitter, she felt a sparkly, bubbly rush, and the world suddenly seemed like a wonderful place, able to contain both the intimate miracle of childbirth and the widely anticipated miracle of space travel. From outer space, the astronauts would be able to see the entire Earth, Nantucket Island and Vietnam both, and something about this comforted Jesse. If she had stopped after the champagne, things might not have spiraled out of control. But when Kate and Jesse came home from the hospital later that morning, Jesse felt a dull headache threatening, and she had learned enough from her mother and grandmother to know that this state was called a hangover, and the only way to stave it off effectively was to continue drinking. When Jesse climbed the stairs to Little Fair, she expected to find Pick. His bike was leaning against the fence, but his bedroom door was closed. Frankly, Jesse was relieved. She opened the refrigerator. The bottom shelf in the door held a regiment of stout brown bottles of Budweiser. Jesse counted. There were 9. The bottles had been there all summer long. Would Mr. Crimmins notice if one was missing? Jesse doubted it, but just to be safe, she spread the bottles out to erase the gap. She retreated to her room with the beer bottle and an opener from the utensil drawer. As she flipped the top off, she was reminded of the lesson about simple machines in her science class. A bottle opener was a lever. She drank the beer. It tasted even worse than the champagne had initially, but after a few concentrated sips, Jesse felt the warm, fuzzy feeling return. She was able to ignore the taste and just gulp it down. She belched. Another beer? She wondered. Her head was starting to swim. That was when she heard voices.